Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Well, it may be summer recess for schools, but not for educators. A demand for the Senate to go back to work. Big labor win in Georgia. Painters speaking out on infrastructure. And today on the show, the latest from the progressive populace and how the Trump NLRB has shut the lights on labor. Good afternoon and welcome to the Friday, July 10th edition of America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America, coast to coast. You can listen to the show, any show we do, wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some examples. We're also posted online. AWFradio.com is our website. We have two guests on the show. Jimmy Cullen will be joining us, longtime contributor to America's Workforce. Populist.com is his website, a twice-monthly magazine of politics, economics, and general news for workers. And you can get a free sample by calling this number, 1-800-205-7067. We're going to talk about his latest editorial, Trump blowing the whistle for his racist base. He says the president can't brag anymore about the economy since his mismanagement of the pandemic has cut 30 million jobs. So what's he doing? He's stoking racism. The president, says Jimmy, styles himself as a law and order president, warning of angry mobs and far-left agitators. But he points out, and there's some polling on this, public opinion is leaning toward the Black Lives Matter movement. He's also going to talk about baby bonds. What's a baby bond? Well, apparently, many in the African-American community are saying because of so much repression over the centuries that they should get some type of a payment. It's called a reparation. Well, Jimmy is of the opinion that's probably not the way to go. An alternative would be for the federal government to set up a baby bonds trust fund for every American child, which would provide an endowment that could be used for college or vocational training or to buy a house when the child reaches adulthood. And this would be across the board for everybody. Interesting idea. We'll talk about that. So Jimmy will be our first guest. Joyce Goldstein will be joining us later in the show. We joined forces with her at the beginning of the year. Goldstein Gregel is her law firm, and they specialize in all kinds of union activity, contract negotiations, law enforcement, public-private sector. And what we're going to talk about today is the Trump NLRB. And apparently, and you should know this by now, but just to reference you, the National Labor Relations Board was created back in the Great Depression in the mid-30s, and it's designed to get both sides to the table and come up with some type of fair and equitable solution when there's labor unrest. Well, the Trump board has repeatedly reversed long-standing board president, weakening workers' rights and giving more power to employers. In the past couple of years that Republicans have held the majority on the board, now there's five people on this board. Three of them are Republicans, and there's supposed to be two Democrats. There's no Democrats on the board right now. Their time was up, and they have not been replaced. So basically, there's three Republicans that are calling all the shots. In the years that the Republicans have held the majority on the board, they have overturned NLRB precedent in more than a dozen cases. All the decisions, all of them, overturning precedent favor employers. None. Zero. Favor workers or unions. In none of these cases did the Trump board follow the NLRB's longstanding practice of seeking public input through what's called amicus briefs before reversing precedent. It's amazing. This has never happened in our history before. And Joyce is going to run down a couple of decisions that were pretty much in stone over the years. And then all of a sudden, this labor board comes in and says, you know what? We don't like that anymore. And they're not favoring workers. So Joyce will be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Really looking forward to a conversation with her. Well, this past Wednesday, hundreds of educators, classroom assistants, healthcare professionals, higher education faculty in a number of states, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Maine, Pennsylvania, Ohio, all took part in a nationwide day of action protesting the U.S. Senate's decision to go on vacation without passing a new COVID-19 relief package that would help the millions of communities struggling to fund basic essential services like public schools, colleges, and hospitals. This was part of a national, what was called Senate Fail Day of Action. They came up with a hashtag for that on Twitter, Senate Fail Day of Action. It included protest campaigns or actions in Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Kentucky, Maine, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, AFT members, American Federation of Teachers members across the country, prepared report cards to deliver to their senators in many states, while others have planned car caravans, socially distant rallies, and press conferences. Also, in addition to the day of action, the teachers launched a second $1 million TV and digital ad buy urging the Senate to return to Washington and pass urgently needed funding so schools can reopen safely. Now, Trump's been saying they got to open. They got to open. Okay. Make sure they're safe. These are our kids. Randy Weingarten is the president of the AFT, and she said America is facing a triple crisis, a health pandemic, a racial justice crisis, and an economic crisis. And instead of facing these crises head on, Mitch McConnell's Senate headed home for the recess. Now, COVID-19 cases are reaching new heights around the country. Healthcare systems are becoming increasingly strained, and working people are facing even greater economic uncertainty as more states halt reopening. Simply put, we cannot get back to work, back to school, back to some kind of new normal without Senate action and without the federal government making critical investments now so we don't forfeit our future. The Senate has failed to move forward with the $3 trillion stimulus package, the HEROES Act, that passed in the House 6 weeks ago and could give our communities the funding they need to combat these crises. But the Senate's refusal to act and its decision to take a vacation in the midst of a crisis show a clear failure of leadership. Now, McConnell, we talked about this briefly on the show with the UAW, he's starting to cave. He's starting to feel the pressure. And he said, okay, we'll come up with another stimulus. It won't be $3 trillion like in the HEROES Act. But he is saying, if you want that stimulus, there's got to be liability protections for the employers. Now, just to explain what that means, he wants to make sure that if companies choose to force employees to return to work, do not provide them protective equipment, or do not create conditions for safe social distancing, the company is not liable if the workers get sick. You heard it right. He wants workers to shoulder the economic costs of the pandemic, not the companies or the shareholders that own those companies. Amazing. Well, the Painters and Allied Trades, also a sponsor of this show, shared its appreciation for the House of Representatives passing the Invest in America Act last week. We talked about this extensively on the show. This is something we had a really good conversation with Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. The legislation includes local prevailing wage standards for federally funded infrastructure projects. The union, under the leadership of General President Ken Rigmaiden, released a statement. For many years, the IUPAT And it's over 140,000 members have relied on job opportunities on American Infrastructure Project to support their families and communities. Well, we continue to urge Senate leadership and the Trump administration to understand the needs of millions of workers and pass a robustly funded infrastructure package, broad in scope, with strong labor standards. The Moving Forward Act provides those opportunities and puts America on a path to economic recovery. Again, another piece of legislation that is kind of stuck because the Republicans don't like the labor provisions in the legislation, among them prevailing wage. It's just amazing to me. We have heard over the years how difficult it is to organize. And I tell you, we've got to give an American Worker Radio salute to IBEW Local 1997. In fact, the national leadership, let's give them a salute here because we're nationally podcast now. Atlanta is now the newest home for gas workers. First local in the state of Georgia in nearly 40 years. That's right. Local 1997 just reached their first ever contract. They will represent 675 gas employees of Atlanta Gas Light, which is a division of Southern Company. The signing ceremony was held at Local 613 Hall, which assisted with the organizing effort and donated office space to the local. The employees voted for representation in April of 2018. It took 60 meetings, 6-0, 60 times they met since January of last year, 2019, to get their first contract. Boy, never say never for unions, you know? Fifth District International Rep Anna Jerry worked with local leaders on negotiations for the contract and said 1981 was the last year a new local was chartered in Georgia. So the workers, they're gas workers, as I pointed out, they'll join workers at Nicor Gas in Illinois and Virginia Natural Gas among the IBEW members working for Southern Company. By the way, the utility conglomerate also has a long-standing relationship with the electrical workers through its electric side subsidiaries, Alabama Power and Georgia Power. So hats off to the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, specifically the new local, Local 1997 in Atlanta, Georgia. First new local in nearly 40 years. All right. Gotta love that. All right. We have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Our segment with Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong, we're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
For over 20 years, organized labor has turned to the BMA Media Group for its communications and events needs, because the BMA Media Group knows how to positively impact labor's issues and spread the union message. The BMA Media Group is a union marketing, public relations, production, and events firm. So BMA Media knows what it takes to market union value for you. To learn how the BMA Media Group can assist your labor organization, just visit www.bmamedia.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. You can listen to the show, any show we do, wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Just some examples there. By the way, this next segment brought to you by the Ohio Federation of Teachers, part of the American Federation of Teachers, OFT-AFT.org. Just talking about the teachers and their National Day of Action a couple of days ago. I could only assume there's going to be more of those between now and November. All right, let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars, Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, here to give us his latest editorial, Trump Whistling His Racist Base. Hey, Jimmy, welcome back to the show. And how are we doing? You're in one of the hot spots in the country. Isn't the virus escalating in Texas right now?
Yeah, we tried to reopen the economy over Memorial Day, and it's been shooting coronavirus ever since. So they've loaded up the ICUs, and now they're talking about fitting out the convention center with ventilators to handle the overflow. So I'm just hunkering down here, as I have been for the past 26 years.
Yeah. it's not strange to you. You've been working out of your home office for years and been doing a good job, I might add. All right, talk to me about your latest editorial here. It actually references what Trump did over the 4th of July weekend. Go ahead.
Yeah, he spent the 4th of July weekend seeking to drive a wedge between his Republican base and those who are working to end his con game. As Trump desperately seeks re-election. In a July 3rd speech at Mount Rushmore, South Dakota, the great misleader warned of angry mobs pursuing far-left fascism and a left-wing cultural revolution that is seeking to remove statues and monuments celebrating Confederate leaders and other U.S. historical figures. And he said, quote, "Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children," he declared. And the following day, he told guests during an Independence Day celebration on the South Lawn of the White House, "We are now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, and the looters." It's just the kind of over-the-top rhetoric that he's using that just shows how far he is off kilter. And police brutality clearly doesn't bother Trump, who in 2017 called on NFL owners to fire Colin Kaepernick and other NFL players who took a knee in protest of police misconduct toward people of color. He said, "That's a total disrespect of our heritage. That's a total disrespect of everything that we stand for," Trump said. Apparently endorsing police brutality as part of American heritage. And after the NFL in 2018 threatened to fine players who kneel during the national anthem, he praised the band, saying, "You have to stand proudly for the national anthem or you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country." And Trump sees little need to reform police departments despite repeated abuses of minorities that have proved fatal in many cases. He appears to be more interested in protecting the memory of Confederate heroes whose rebellion against the United States, with the primary purpose of preserving slavery, cost more than 618,000 American lives. And Trump, who has shown reckless disregard for the truth throughout his presidency, wants to run as the law and order candidate against a threat he has created. He seized on a quote by a man who runs a fringe group that claims to be affiliated with Black Lives Matter in a June 25th tweet. He said, "Black Lives Matter leader states, if U.S. doesn't give us what we want, then we will burn down this system and replace it. This is treason, sedition, insurrection," Trump tweeted. And Trump actually was quoting Walter Hawk Newsom, who was a guest on Fox News earlier in the day. Newsom also said that BLM activists should be applauded for arming themselves with guns. But a BLM spokesman told CNBC, that as BLM has told Mr. Newsom in the past, and as is still true today, Mr. Newsom's group is not a chapter of Black Lives Matter and has not entered into any agreement with BLM agreeing to adhere to BLM's core principles. And a review of the BLM website does not indicate support for attacking police, looting or burning businesses, toppling statues of former slaveholders, or changing the name of Washington, D.C., among other controversial positions that have been attributed to the movement. BLM expresses a commitment to struggling together and to imagining and creating a world free of anti-blackness, where every black person has the social, economic, and political power to thrive, unquote. And BLM appears to be winning public support. A national poll by Ipsos for Public Agenda in USA Today, released June 29th, found that 58% say that racial bias against black Americans by police and law enforcement is a serious problem in their community, and 55% of Americans want either major change or to redesign police departments completely, and only 7% want police to stay the same. Wow. The poll also found 60% would support forcing officers to reapply for their jobs to help weed out bad cops, and 63% would limit the scope of policing to focus on serious and violent crimes. But police were split over whether to cut off police departments' ability to buy military gear, though 50% did support demilitarization. And media critic Eric Bollert noted that CNN labeled Trump's addresses at Mount Rushmore as impassioned, and the Associated Press reported that Trump was merely offering a discordant tone, and the Minneapolis Star Tribune's front page portrayed the event as, quote, patriotic, unquote. Bollert, who writes at PressRun.media, added, across the media landscape, Trump's bizarre, unsettling address was whitewashed and described as being, quote, fiery, unquote. There comes a point, and we're way past it, when reporters covering Trump should be honest with what they're witnessing. It shouldn't be left to opinion writers to note that Trump's speeches aren't merely divisive, as the New York Times reported on July 3rd. The speech was undemocratic, as Trump demonized civil protesters and dangerous, as he portrayed them as lurking enemies of the state, unquote.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you going back, and you did a piece prior to this one with regard to what happened at Lafayette Park. And in that case, he pretty much violated the First Amendment, didn't he? When he basically stormed on the protesters?
Yeah, he basically overplayed his hand, berating local and state officials as weak for not doing more to put down the rallies that protested the May 25th killing of George Floyd in the custody of Minneapolis police. And he actually violated every tenet of the First Amendment. A half hour before the curfew was supposed to take effect at the White House on June 1st, Trump's minions ordered troops guarding the White House to clear a peaceful crowd from Lafayette Park that included protesters and credentialed journalists. And the stormtroopers used tear gas canisters, grenades containing rubber pellets, and flash bombs to scatter the crowd. They also gassed a priest and a seminarian who were providing aid to protesters in front of St. John's Episcopal Church to clear the way for Trump to take a photo op brandishing a Bible in front of the boarded-up church. So he violated the people's right peaceably to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. He abridged the freedom of speech in the press, and he interfered with the nearby church and attacked its clergy, which provoked a blistering response from the Episcopal bishop.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's kind of like the hat trick of First Amendment violations.
Yeah. You pointed out, too, he invoked, what was this, the 1807 Insurrection Act to send in the federal troops? Is that right?
Yeah. He had ordered, I think, the 82nd Airborne Division up from North Carolina and had them on hand with bayonets ready to go. But apparently somebody persuaded him that wasn't a good look.
Yeah, calm down, Mr. President. Calm down.
Yeah.
Wow.
It apparently was one boneheaded move too many for Jim Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense, who previously had refused to criticize Trump but the retired military general finally blew his top, calling Trump the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unify the American people. Instead, he tries to divide us. And he asked Americans to reject and hold accountable those in office who would make a mockery of our Constitution.
Yeah, it's hard to believe what's going on in America. And it's all reported by Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist. For more information, go to populist.com. We'll continue the conversation talking about baby bombs. Also, later in the show, Cleveland attorney Joyce Goldstein will be talking about the National Labor Relations Board and how it has been eviscerated by this administration. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
You won't find more comprehensive coverage of the issues most important to Ohio's labor trades than in the pages of the Labor Citizen. The full-color tabloid is delivered to thousands of union construction workers each month, providing reports from local unions, interesting feature stories, and news that impacts Ohio's union construction industry. But the only way this valuable monthly publication can be delivered to your mailbox is if your local union decides to join. If your building trades union membership is not receiving the Labor Citizen, ask why at your next regular meeting, or send an email to info@laborcitizen.com.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
Welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. You can listen to this show, any show we do, wherever you stream podcasts. iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some examples. So once you get hooked on the show, please subscribe to our podcast. Give us a rating. We'd appreciate a good rating. 5 stars would be real nice. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, talking about his latest editorial here. This is actually for August 1st, so we're way ahead of the game. Baby bonds could boost low-income kids. Jimmy, talk to me about this. What are baby bonds?
Well, many African-Americans are calling for the federal government to pay reparations to descendants of slaves. But we don't think it's a practical way to address inequalities in the United States, because Americans have received compensation for injustices done to them, but we usually don't wait more than 150 years after the injustices to pay the injured parties. And descendants of Union soldiers who fought and died to free the slaves might argue that they should not now be taxed to pay for reparations to the descendants of those freed slaves. And, in fact, an Ipsos poll conducted for the Associated Press in June found that 73% of respondents oppose reparations for black Americans whose ancestors were slaves as compensation for that slavery. But an alternative to reparations that might have more broad-based appeal is a proposal that the federal government set up a baby bonds trust fund for every American child, which would provide an endowment that could be used for college or vocational training or for other expenses such as to buy a house when the child reaches adulthood. And the concept of a government-funded nest egg is not unprecedented. Thomas Paine in 1797 called for the government to provide 15 pounds, approximately $1,800 today, to every 21-year-old. And under the American Opportunity Accounts Act, proposal by Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, roughly 4 million children who are born every year in the U.S. would receive $1,000 in interest-bearing American Opportunity accounts managed by the Treasury Department with an estimated 3% annual return. And the government would contribute up to $2,000 to each account every year, with lower-income children receiving the largest payments. And by age 18, the children from low-income families would receive $46,200 total in their accounts, while wealthier children, those in families at five times the poverty level, or $147,000 for a family of four, would end up with $1,681, which would be the original $1,000 payment plus earnings accrued from the government investing it in the low-risk funds. And that's according to an analysis by Booker's office. And blacks and Latinos would collect nearly twice the amount than average as whites would on average, the analysis found. And Booker's plan also would fund existing children that they picked up along the way. And the program would cost about $60 billion per year, which could be paid for by restoring estate taxes on wealthy Americans to 2009 levels and closing the tax break for inherited capital gains. And the baby bond program should be attractive for working class families of all ethnic descriptions, and it has a lot more favorable prospects for passage than a reparations program that would generate considerable resentment. And baby bonds would do more good for more people at the expense of the 1%. So what's not to like?
Interesting concept. And you're saying that Thomas Paine, we're going back to Revolutionary War days, he's the guy that originally came up with this concept?
Yeah.
Wow.
And people have tried similar things. As a matter of fact, the Ford Foundation has an experimental program in Oklahoma right now. They started, I think, in the 90s, giving children $1,000 at birth and promising that once they reached adulthood, they could use it for their college expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's a much more limited program.
Is that still going on, to your knowledge, what they're doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It's been going on for about 20 years, apparently.
You know, Thomas Paine, if he were around today, they'd probably get shot for coming up with something like this. You know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, Donald Trump.
It's too radical.
Bad-mouthing him.
It's too radical. It's socialist. You can't do that kind of thing, and we don't have any money to do it. Well, it's an interesting concept. Baby bonds could boost low-income kids. I'm sure they'd have to come up with some guidelines on that as well. All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Again, the Progressive Populist, twice monthly magazine of politics, economics, general news for workers, small businesses, you name it. Trial subscription, $18 for 6 months. That'll get you 11 issues. You can get a free sample by calling this number, 1-800-205-7067, and check them out at populist.com. You take care. Be safe. We'll talk to you in August, my friend, okay?
Okay, thanks.
All right, quick break. Joyce Goldstein's going to take a look at the National Labor Relations Board right here on America's Workforce, back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay good benefits and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action La Una, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word La Una to the number 69866. Through the La Una Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers across America. You can find us online, awfradio.com, and listen to the show wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Just some examples. Let's go to line number two. Welcome back to the show, Joyce Goldstein, and she is the Goldstein of Goldstein Gregel, which represents public and private unions, fringe benefit funds, employees in the construction, industrial service, professional, and law enforcement sectors. Goldstein Gregel. Joyce Goldstein, welcome back to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Flash. Thanks for having me.
Today, we are going to talk about the National Labor Relations Board, and there's specific areas we're going to get into, and the whole idea here is to take a look at what this board is all about and how they have ruled pretty much against workers over the last several years here. Why don't we go back into what is in the 1930s? Was it 1935 when this board was created? Let's start there just to educate our listeners on what the National Labor Relations Board actually is and what it should be doing. So let's start there, Joyce. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. So the National Labor Relations Board was established as one of the New Deal programs from President Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, and it was established for the purpose of giving workers rights, the right to organize and engage in collective bargaining, and to protect and foster that right. So that was the original idea of it, and it's the board is a 5-member board by statute, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and that's been the law has been essentially the same law since 1935. It was amended in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, and those amendments were designed to restrict union power, which had been previously granted in the 1935 Act. So there were some restrictions, but except for that, the law has been the same law since the 1930s. And, of course, it's been dependent upon the 5-member board to implement it and enforce it, and that has changed over the years depending on who the president is and who gets appointed to the board.
Mm-hmm. So when there's a Democratic president, you have 3 Democrats on the board, 2 Republicans, and vice versa when there's a Republican in the White House. But right now, I guess it's not fully staffed. We don't have 5 members right now. Is that my understanding?
That's correct. Oh, so the board members serve for a term, and as it works out, as you said, typically there are 3 members of the majority party, whoever is the president in office at the time, and 2 members of the minority party. So there is always some balance, but obviously more weight given to the majority party that's running the government. That's not the case now. Instead of having a 5-member board, we actually right now, and since the end of 2019, we have only had a 3-member board, and the 3 members are 3 Republicans, all of whom were appointed by Trump. There are 3 white men, no women, no people of color, and no Democrats. And as I say, in the past, it's always been 3-2. And that's really significant because the board hears cases in panels of three most of the time. There are times where the full board of five, if there is a full board of five, also will consider a case. But typically, cases are heard by just panels of three. So there could be, and have historically been, many, many occasions where you would have a panel made up of two of the minority members plus one of the majority members. So you could have, you know, the two Democrats, if there were only two Democrats and one Republican. And so those decisions would tend to be more favorable to workers and unions, because Democrats mm-hmm. historically appointed to the board have issued decisions more favorable to unions and workers. And conversely, when the Republicans are in charge, they issue decisions that are more favorable to employers and are anti-union and anti-worker. So now that we only have three Republican members of the board, there's no possibility, of course, that that we could ever have a decision issued by a Democratic majority panel. And even if there was one more Democratic member on the panel of five, so let's say it was 3-1, you could still never have, by definition, a majority Democratic panel, because there's only one. So they're always going to be in the minority. And that's that appears to be what will happen, at least to the end of this Trump administration.
Now, what we're seeing, especially with this board, I mean, it sets labor precedent, as you pointed out. They're taking a look at old decisions and kind of revising them, and they're not in favor of unions. Let's get into some of the topics here. Explain to me this, what is it called, contract bar? Contract bar? Now, what's that all about, Joyce?
Sure. Let me, before I say, and I'll talk about the contract bar theory in a sec, but just to say to your first point there, what happened was back at the beginning of the Trump administration, the Chamber of Commerce publicly issued their agenda of what would be most favorable to employers that they'd like to see the NLRB do. And mm-hmm. that agenda came out, as I say, quite publicly in February of 2017. At this point, the Republican-controlled NLRB has completely implemented the Chamber of Commerce's agenda that was put out there in early 2017. So that is indeed who's controlling what the wow. what the decisions are and the outcome in those. So the one that you mentioned in particular, the contract bar, this is an issue that will be coming up. It has not, there isn't a decision yet issued on it. But what it means is this, is that typically collective bargaining agreements last for 3 years. And the law for half a century or more has been that during the term of an existing collective bargaining agreement, that there will be stable labor relations during the term of that contract. And what that means is that if somebody, a disgruntled employee, wanted to file a petition at the NLRB to try to throw out the union, that they cannot do that. The NLRB will not entertain a petition to throw out the union, to hold an election, to decertify the union during the term of an existing 3-year agreement. That if at the end of the contract term that employee wants to file a petition to decertify the union, to throw them out, then the NLRB will entertain that petition. And if there's 30% interest of the members of the bargaining unit who want to have an election, then the NLRB will hold an election to see whether the workers still want the union to represent them. But as I say, that process would never occur at all during the 3 years of the collective bargaining agreement. Now, what's happened is that there is a new case that is pending at the NLRB. And earlier this week, the NLRB sent out a notice. They put a notice out on their website and to the universe saying that they are going to use this particular case that's pending as a way to reexamine the contract bar theory And so they've asked any parties who might be interested in filing a friend of the court, a friend of the board brief, that they have the opportunity to do that. And the question that the board will be looking at is whether to continue the contract bar theory, to abandon it, or to modify it in some way. And as I said, this has been the law of the land for half a century that we've had the contract bar in place. And it's something that is beneficial to everyone, because it's not just beneficial to the workers and the unions to have stable relations, but for many employers, it's beneficial to them also, because they're not going to be in the middle of an election campaign while they're trying to run their business and conduct their affairs. So it would be, as I say, really destabilizing to the whole relationship. Yet, if the goal is to try to undermine the strength of unions, which clearly is what the Trump board is all about, this is the opportunity to do that. So
wow.
This is the way to, to distract a union from doing what it is intended to do, to represent the members, to file and process grievances, to represent their interests, and instead to be caught off guard, deal with, an attack on its very existence.
Mm-hmm. Is this one of the things the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been trying to push upon this board?
Yeah, the contract bar issue is one of many that has been on the chamber's agenda. We're now moving into almost a secondary agenda, because the top 10 on that agenda have really already been implemented by this board.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, this is amazing. And you said that they're looking for a friend of the court right now, and which they'll probably get in this case, and then they'll move forward with it? Is that how the process works, Joyce?
Yeah, so the process is that, as I say, the case is pending now before the board. They put out an open notice to anyone who wants to file a brief to weigh in on the question, that they have the opportunity to do that. But what we've seen from this board over the last couple of years is that once they set out that this is what they're going to do, they do it. They do
yeah.
it. And in each case, as you indicated before, this board has overturned well over a dozen precedent. And in every single case, it's been in favor of an employer and against workers and their unions.
Amazing. We have time for another one here. Blocking charge. What's the blocking charge all about?
So blocking charge, I know these sound like these arcane issues of labor law, but they really do have a lot of significant impact on people's lives. So the blocking charge rule has been this, is that if an employer allegedly commits an unfair labor practice during the course of an organizing campaign. So let's say an employer fires a union supporter, just to terrorize everyone in the bargaining unit and to,
right.
to put the fear in all of them. If that happens during the course of an organizing campaign, that an employer engages in an unfair labor practice and a charge is filed, what the board has done is they will not proceed with an election if there is, so let's say that a union is trying to organize a workplace, and as I say, that the employer then engages in an egregious unfair labor practice like firing union supporters. The NLRB will say that the charge, the unfair labor practice charge, blocks the election. So what they're saying is that there's not a possibility to have a free and fair election if an employer has acted in such a coercive manner. Now, what this board is saying is they've abandoned the blocking charge rule. They have abandoned the blocking charge rule. So now what they're doing is they're saying, again, contrary to existing precedent for decades, is they're saying that even if an employer engages in serious unfair labor practices in the course of an organizing campaign, that the board will still go ahead and have an election notwithstanding that, that they'll still go ahead and, like, ignore the fact that the employer has engaged in terrible things, which could obviously affect the impact of an election.
Oh, sure. If that's the case, they'll be encouraged to do everything possible. Wow.
Right.
That's amazing. Just amazing. We got a couple minutes left here. There's another one here, and this one really caught my attention. Restricting union communication at work. This sounds like a real hot potato. What's at play here, Joyce?
So, of course, an employer has the right to talk to its employees whenever it wants about whatever it wants. So employers can talk anti-union often. If, again, and let's put it in an organizing campaign context, an employer is free to bash the union, tell workers why it's not in their interest to have a union. An employer can communicate that any way the employer wants to. And one of the most popular ways that employers do that are what are called captive audience speeches, where an employer will require employees to attend a meeting on penalty of discipline if they don't. And at that meeting, the employer will bring in their anti-union thugs or whoever to talk about why it's not in the workers' interest to support a union. On the other hand, unions, of course, don't have that kind of access to workers during an organizing campaign to explain to them why it really is in their best interest to engage collectively and have a union. So the opportunities for union communication or for employees to be communicating with other employees in support of a union campaign is much more limited. And what this board has done is they've taken those limitations and put the squeeze on and made them even worse. So, for example, there had been a decision from the Obama board called Purple Communications that had to do with use of employer email systems. So if an employer had an email system that employees could use to talk about whatever they want in addition to work-related stuff, the Obama board had said that an employer could not restrict that and say you can't use it to have union conversations. Trump board reversed that. So now an employer can restrict use of employer email systems to say you can't talk about the union. Access to property is another one where the Trump board has restricted union opportunity to speak. So let's say, like, there was a hospital case and there's a cafeteria in the hospital that's open to the public. It used to be that a union organizer could go into the public cafeteria and talk to workers during their lunch break or coffee break and
sure.
could talk about the union, just like anybody else could be in the cafeteria talking about whatever they're going to be talking about. Now, according to the Trump board, it's okay to throw out the union organizer, to say, no, it's okay for anybody else in the public to have conversations in the hospital cafeteria, but not the union organizer. Similarly, they've restricted access of an employee who goes back to their property, like to the employer property on non-work time. If that employee goes back to the property on non-work time, they cannot go back for the purpose of talking about union issues with their coworkers. They've restricted access in parking lots. So let's say the Salvation Army is free to be out in a parking lot outside the grocery store to do their solicitations. The board had held before that if a union is outside in the parking lot to talk to workers or others coming and going, that was okay so long as you allowed Salvation Army, Boy Scouts, and, you know, other groups to be out there with their message. Now the Trump board said, nope, it's okay to allow all those other groups and prevent the union from being able to access workers in the parking lot. So,
jeez.
I mean, the list goes on,
you know,
the unfair access cases.
Unbelievable. Well, I tell you, there's a lot more, and we'll save it for the next show. How's that sound, Joyce? Because
great.
it seems to be a never-ending story here. We appreciate your time. Professor Goldstein, we learned a lot today on the show, so thank you very much. You have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you in August, okay?
Great. Thank you so much.
Joyce Goldstein, GoldsteinGregel.com for more information. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the latest from the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council, the new guy at Helmets to Hard Hats, and Terry O'Sullivan of Laborers International. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.